that concept of impactful projection as something new. It's essentially old wine in a new bottle, in the sense that we are essentially practicing traditional deterrence by denial, but at greater distance from Australia. And I think that, you know, this marks a forward step for Australia in many respects in how we think about defence.
From the Defence and Aerospace Report, this is The Downlink, a podcast about the intersection of space, the space business, and defence. Not just what's over the horizon, but what's happening above it. I'm your host, Laura Winter.
So while many have been drilling down into the nuts and bolts of the U.S. defense budget, two of the United States' closest allies, Britain and Australia, have been making some adjustments of their own. This week, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced that his government plans to grow the U.K.'s defense budget to 2.5% of GDP, and Australia just released its biannual national defense strategy, which calls for roughly 12 billion Australian dollars in investment in space systems over 10 years. Lest we forget, the US, Britain, and Australia are the three members of the Trilateral Strategic Defense Alliance known as AUKUS. Its basis was a deal in 2021 to provide conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. That's the first pillar of the agreement. The other, or pillar two, requires all to develop advanced space capabilities, which include space systems. Both pillars are meant to put the three nations on a stronger footing and improve regional security in the Pacific. In that region, China has become more forcefully belligerent in imposing its disputed territorial claims in the region. An international tribunal in The Hague ruled in 2016 that China's claims and its actions violated international law. Well, surprise, surprise, in the year since, China has not ceased but stepped up its illegal behavior. And that's prompted U.S. allies in the Pacific region to plus up their defense budgets as well as develop pathways to join mutual defense pacts. This week, China and North Korea are complaining that Japan is seeking membership in the AUKUS agreement. That's the backdrop for this episode's discussion, in which we have space and international security experts Malcolm Davis in Canberra and Juliana Zeus in London. But first, a message from our generous sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by TE Connectivity. When the mission is critical, so are the parts. TE Connectivity's components are exactingly engineered, rigorously tested, and certified by major space agencies. Learn more at te.com/space. Now here's our conversation. Hello, Juliana. Malcolm, thank you both so much for joining me on the Downlink podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Now, before we begin our chat about the state of space and defense with the two of the United States' closest allies, the UK and Australia, parties to the AUKUS agreement, please take a moment to introduce yourselves. And Malcolm, why don't you start us off?
Thanks, Laura, for having me. It's great to be here with you and also great to be chatting with you, Juliana. I'm Dr. Malcolm Davis. I'm a senior analyst in defense strategy and capability at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. And I focus on all things space policy and space security, future warfare and defence policy.
And Juliana?
Hi, Laura. It's great to be back. And likewise, Malcolm, it's great to be chatting again. My name's Juliana Zeus, and I'm the research fellow for space security as part of the military sciences team at RUSI in London. I also host a podcast in which both Laura and Malcolm have been guests. It's called War in Space. And similarly to Malcolm, I focus on space security. So that includes how the military already integrates space, but also in the ways in which space security plays out in orbit as well.
So, Juliana, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced a plan to grow Britain's defence budget to 2.5% of gross domestic product in roughly 5.5 years, by 2030. He made this announcement in Poland. And he was there with the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk. and they visited British troops. The UK is leading NATO's Allied Rapid Response Force. It's been reported that the defense budget increase is £75 billion or $93 billion, and it's going to be spent on putting the industrial base on a war footing and creating a defense innovation agency. The Prime Minister's office said this will include research and development for space systems. Why did the Prime Minister make this announcement now? What do you think this new agency will set out to do? And what does this mean for Britain's military space systems? Juliana?
Yeah, thank you, Laura, for that comprehensive overview. I think it's important to sort of see the announcement in the context in which it's taking place in. Obviously, aid for Ukraine has been going on for quite some time. So there's a sort of need to replenish. Seeing it also in sort of the political context in which this is taking place, the UK is facing a general election in the next couple of months. It will have to take place before the end of January 2025 as well. I think it's quite important to note, you mentioned the percentage figure, but you also mentioned the sort of projected sort of actual budget that entails. We're sort of still in debates and sort of, you know, how is that baseline drawn? Obviously, that figure was also used sort of using the NATO criteria of what that spending entails. But also the 75 billion figure that you mentioned is based on a sort of specific suggestion of where the economic growth might lead. So I do think we need to sort of look at it in that sort of context. Now, you mentioned defence innovation. And yes, it was said that 5% would be spent on R&D, so research and development. But we don't have any sort of tangible indication on what that will actually be spent on. If we're looking at the sort of plans now and where the money is going, then that increase, and yes, it is a sort of sizable increase, perhaps one of the largest that we've seen in the last few decades. But as I said before, there is a need to replenish. And if we're looking at what that plan would currently do, it would buy ammunition, yes. But it would also mean that the current equipment plan becomes affordable, because what we're currently looking at is actually a funding gap.
Interesting. You know, the Prime Minister called this generational. I mean, is it generational, this kind of bump?
Yes, I mean, certainly, as I said, it is one of the largest sort of increases that we've seen in the last few decades. But obviously, it will remain to be seen sort of how quickly that can be put into action, what the political landscape of the UK will look like by that time, and sort of what gaps will need to be filled.
Now, staying with this, and also staying with UK space systems, last week you gave oral evidence to the House of Lords, to the International Relations and Defense Committee, about the role of space systems in Ukraine, lessons learned, and what actions Britain should take. So what did the committee members actually ask, and what lessons do you hope that they have taken away, especially in light of the Prime Minister's announcement to increase defense spending?
Yes, so the evidence session was part of the inquiry on Ukraine. So this was simply the sort of space-specific session. So most of the questions were around how Russia has been using space capabilities, how Ukraine has leveraged space capabilities, despite not being a sort of formal space power in the way that Russia is usually sort of described, but also what the implications are, right? Because I think specifically in the context of Ukraine, we're talking about the sort of commercialization of space more and more. Obviously, commercial space companies have played a significant role on the Ukrainian side. And sort of, you know, what are the takeaways and what are the implications for UK defense as well? Some really important questions there that sort of remain to be answered. I think the main lessons that I had hoped that they would take away and that I mentioned in my final recommendations to the committee are threefold. That is that space is not niche and should not be treated as such by the armed forces. Specifically, the UK space power doctrine already says that the vast majority of military operations would not function in the way that they currently do without space. So we can't see it as a sort of luxury add-on that we can have. Instead, it's essential that a lot of the other capabilities are built on top of. And number two is that the disruption of space is not a matter of whether or if, but it's a question of when. So we do have to think about the resilience of space systems and sort of what that will look like, sort of should the UK military be deployed. I think we do have to train for the case of disruption or degradation of space systems in a future war. Specifically because historically, obviously, if we're looking at the previous operations that the UK has been involved in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, there wasn't really those counter space elements in the form that we might see in a future conflict. And then lastly, I think there's a sense of realism that needs to be deployed when we're talking about forward planning or procurement when it comes to space. You know, we always hear about how difficult and how expensive space is. And, you know, that's true. That shouldn't, you know, prevent us from trying. But I do think that a country like the UK, which obviously has a much smaller budget than the US, for example, does need to set its priorities and does need to be a little more careful in setting those priorities as well.
And in setting those priorities, just because you use the word priorities, what would be a priority? What is your number one priority, you think?
That's a good question. I think if we're looking at the three big categories of defense space, we've obviously got SATCOM, we have ISR, so intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and we have PNT, so positioning, navigation, and timing. At SATCOM, the UK is actually pretty set when it comes to satellite communications. There's a Skynet program that has been running for decades, since the 60s, that is a sort of geostationary constellation. So I think SATCOM is a sort of legacy program that the UK has been able to invest in for quite some time. If we're looking at ISR and PNT, that's not quite the case. Obviously, with PNT, the UK is no longer part of the EU, so therefore it also no longer has access to Galileo, which is the EU's navigation system. So it is sort of solely reliant on GPS. I think what would be needed there is a sort of terrestrial alternative or sort of alternative in case of disruption. And then with looking at ISR, sort of imaging capabilities, general surveillance capabilities, I think there's clearly a gap here. So if we're looking towards the EU, there is the Copernicus program, which is an imaging constellation. And yes, the UK does still have access to that. That has been sort of relatively recently negotiated. But I think there's definitely room for improvement and sort of diversification of those capabilities.
Thank you so much for that roundup and overview. Now, Malcolm, Australia's Department of Defense produces a national defense strategy document every 2 years. I'm, of course, approaching this with a foreigner's eyes and was curious to read in the foreword that this is a fundamentally new approach to the defense of Australia and its interests, and that the National Defense Strategy will see a strategy of denial become the cornerstone of defense planning. So what is a strategy of denial? What does that mean for Australia's efforts in the space domain? And is this new strategy fundamentally new?
Well, let's get with that last point first. I know what the document says, but it's actually not new, it's old. Just to confuse people. Essentially, the strategy of denial or deterrence by denial is designed to increase the potential cost of an adversary projecting power or force against Australia or its interests at distance. So we are investing in longer range strike capabilities, including conventionally armed but nuclear powered submarines, designed to raise the cost to an adversary. If that adversary were to try and project a threat against Australia. Now, this is nothing new in the sense that when you go back through past Australian defence white papers all the way back to 1987's Defence of Australia, effectively they have deterrence by denial. They have variations on that theme. So the current government has basically tried to portray this as something new, but it's actually quite an old concept. Where I think we are looking at something new is in the geographic expanse of how we practice deterrence by denial with this new national defense strategy. In comparison to the older strategies going back to 1987, there was very much a focus on continental defense and defense of the sea air gap to our north, that maritime region north of Australia between Australia and Indonesia. Now what we're trying to do is actually have what's known as impactful projection forward of the archipelago to our north, further from Australia, to hold at risk an adversary's forces at greater distance. And so we're starting to invest in the sorts of capabilities in terms of long-range standoff weapons, the nuclear-powered submarines, more advanced naval capabilities, that will enable us to do that. And I think the government is probably trying to portray that concept of impactful projection as something new. It's essentially old wine in a new bottle, in the sense that we are essentially practicing traditional deterrence by denial, but at greater distance from Australia. And I think that, you know, this marks a forward step for Australia in many respects in how we think about defence. But the challenge, of course, is how soon can we bring these sorts of capabilities online? Will we have the money to sustain them? And how do we ensure that deterrence by denial is effective and credible in the eyes of our opponents, particularly China?
And what does it mean then for Australia's efforts in the space domain?
Okay, well, Australia is an old new space power. If you look at Australia's history, you know, we've been active in the space sector really since the beginning of the space age, where we supported the European Launcher Development Organization, ELDO, which was the forerunner to the European Space Agency back in the 60s with launches from Woomera. We gave up on all of that once ELDO moved to French Guiana and Kourou. And we haven't really done anything with space until very recently, until about 2015, 2017, when I think government conducted a review of the commercial space sector, and they realized that the commercial space sector was a potential growth area of the economy in terms of growing not only a high technology sector, but also growing jobs, having Australia being able to do more than just be a passive onlooker to the rapidly growing international commercial space sector, the potential of that global space sector reaching, you know, $1.5 trillion by 2040, you know, we had a fundamental choice. Do we stand by and be dependent on others to provide space capabilities for us, or do we take advantage of our commercial space sector and our high technology sector to be able to provide a more active role in space? And so we chose the latter. We stood up the Australian Space Agency in 2018, we established the Defence Space Command in 2022. And, you know, we're now recognising that space is really important, both from a commercial and a national sense, but also from a defence perspective. And when you look at how the 2024 National Defence Strategy treats space, they tend to focus on three areas. So unlike the UK, which seems to distinguish between SATCOM, ISR and then PNT, we focus on provision of space services, which brings those three capability areas together as the first leg. The second leg is space domain awareness is both Earth-based and space-based. So we have, for example, an Earth-based space surveillance telescope, and we're now establishing the Deep Space Advanced Radar capability out at Exmouth in Western Australia. That will give us the ability to look up to geo and to monitor activities in geo.
Thank you for mentioning that, because that was new from, what was it, December? I think it was spoken about in October, but then it actually became formal in December, and I was hoping to get to that. So thank you.
Yeah. And we also have commercial space domain awareness that complements that. And the third part of how the National Defence Strategy treats space is space control. And this is something new because, you know, really we haven't begun to think seriously about space control until the last 12 months.
And what does space control really mean, though? Just because those are words that are English, and, you know, the concepts are kind of understandable. But what does that mean, you know, really in this context?
Well, space control means the ability to defend and defeat any threats against our satellites or the satellites of our allies. Now, how we do that is still being debated. There has been talk of a project underway for space-based electronic warfare. But I think that, you know, whilst we're never going to invest in anti-satellite weapons per se, I do think we are going to be focusing very much on defensive capabilities to protect satellites and also space resilience, the ability to ensure that we have access to space to reduce the effectiveness of any counter space threat used against us. I think where the National Defence Strategy and it's the accompanying integrated investment program falls down in space is that it does not link the commercial space sector in this country to the defence and national security missions. Australia is geographically blessed in terms of sovereign launch, in terms of having territory that's close to the equator to take advantage of Earth's rotational energy to deliver lower cost of payload in kilograms to equatorial orbit in LEO. And also from launch sites in the south of the continent, we are ideally placed for accessing sun-synchronous and polar orbits. So we should be taking advantage of that sovereign launch capability to support defence and national security missions, but the National Defence Strategy doesn't make that connection. And I've just recently released an article on the ASPE strategist focusing very much on this. So that's a quick snapshot of where we've come from in space, where we are now, and where we're potentially going under the National Defence Strategy.
That was actually not just a snapshot. That was a wonderful album. Before we get into the deeper details, which I'm not sure how much deeper we are going to go, but what I found refreshing, actually, and this is, from my perspective here in Washington, D.C., where we seem to, struggle to actually produce an annual budget, was that with the investment program paper that came out with this strategy, this is a 10-year look on how to invest, a 10-year strategy for investment, and that it calls for just above 12 billion Australian dollars in investment into space. I've got to wonder, is a 10-year time frame normal for this kind of thinking, and does it actually stick?
Well, it's very interesting. The 2020 Defence Strategic Update of the previous government, which was essentially the last white paper before the current government came into power, recognised that the rapidly deteriorating strategic environment that we're in means we no longer can hold to the traditional assumption that we will have 10 years of strategic warning time for a major power conflict that would threaten Australia. So that assumption went out in 2020. The 2023 Defence Strategic Review of the current government recognised and accepted that assumption was no longer fit for purpose. And now the 2024 National Defence Strategy and the Integrated Investment Program reinforces that argument that we no longer have 10 years of strategic warning time. But when you look at all the capability investments and the acquisition programs that are flagged by the Integrated Investment Program, they're all 10-year programs. They are all basically seeing the funding for boosting defence spending being back-ended out to 10 years rather than here and now. And I think that this is the principal criticism of the National Defence Strategy and the Integrated Investment Program, is that there's a disconnect between the strategic, the perception of the strategic outlook, which is rapidly deteriorating, with the National Defence Strategy even stating that it's deteriorated since the release of the 2023 Defence Strategic Review, versus the actual capability acquisition process to respond to that mounting threat. And space, I think, suffers from the same problem. There's a 10-year mindset in capability acquisition that doesn't match the immediacy of the threat that we're facing in terms of, the overall threat in the region, from China and the issue of Taiwan and so forth. But in terms of space, the rapid growth of counter space capabilities and the risk that we could lose access to space.
It's a really interesting juxtaposition when you compare that to, how our funding rounds are going here in the United States, because, here in the United States, just in the last podcast, for instance, there have been many complaints about how continuing resolutions, annual budgets not being passed on time, stymies, acquisition, the beginning of new projects. I wouldn't say programs of record, but I do mean projects. And it's making it very difficult to keep things on track because there isn't a long-term view. It just seems to go, basically year by year, if we're lucky, right? So I really appreciate that. It's just a very interesting, different view. But also in reading the strategy and then the integrated investment program, I found a statement that, quote, the government has had to make the hard but necessary decisions to cancel, divest, delay, or rescope, unquote. So the real question for the listeners of this podcast is whether military space programs are getting plussed up or chopped. And I remember, and after also speaking with you about it on a number of occasions, that about 11 months ago, the Albanese government axed what should have been Australia's first national space mission, the National Space Mission for Earth Observation, or NSMEO, or NSMEO. I'm not sure you always say the acronym better than I do. And I remember that this was a hugely unpopular decision. And here we are, possibly weeks away before another national budget, I'm assuming, imagining, I could be wrong. And I noticed the wording in the National Defense Strategy that calls for continued investments in space systems. So how do you think this is really going to shake out?
Well, that's a really good question. And the NSMEO travesty, I think, is the only word to describe it, you know, really did anger a lot of people in the space community because, you know, that would have created large numbers of jobs in Australia. It would have allowed us to develop a sovereign Earth observation capability and gain huge experience in doing so. And we could have even launched that capability from Australia, given that we're a couple of months away from achieving our first launch from an Australian spaceport with an Australian rocket. I think that looking forward with the funding side of things, as you say, the May 14 budget will be really critical in terms of seeing how that translates, not just for defence and national security, but also for industry, science and innovation, which is the portfolio where the Australian Space Agency sits. And you have a minister there that is, I think, to put it bluntly, quite indifferent to space. So there are some tough times there in that regard. I think that the National Defence Strategy and the Integrated Investment Program's perspective on funding, once again, says let's continue the funding, but in focusing on these three areas of provision of services, space domain awareness, and space control. And let's see what happens in terms of the actual spread of that funding over both the forward estimates, which is the next 4 years, and then the rest of the decade. And I think that the challenge we face is that the government is basically making a bet that nothing bad will happen in the next decade and that somehow they'll get through that decade and then have all these advanced capabilities, including space capabilities, available to counter coercion in the 2030s and beyond. But that's a big bet to make. You know, when you look at increasing tensions in the region, particularly over Taiwan. So you know, luckily, the National Defence Strategy and the Integrated Investment Program is a biennial process. So we get another one in 2026. And of course, there is also the possibility of a change of government by 2025. So you could then have a different perspective on this that could see space funding rise because the previous coalition government was much more supportive of space than the current government. I don't think you're going to see a dramatic cut in space. It's more likely that if in a worst case scenario, the current government just lets space wither on the vine, particularly in the civil side of things with the industry, innovation and science portfolio.
Now that we've got the state of play from the UK and Australia, you know, from the both of you, I'm wondering how this will all be integrated into the AUKUS agreement. And I'm using the word integrated very pointedly because it's becoming a very popular word here in Britain and Europe and in Australia. So how is this all going to get integrated? I mean, our governments are all using this word, right?
Who wants to go first on that?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
Wow, so I'll let Juliana take that one.
That's a great question, Laura. And I think one that we'll probably be discussing for quite some time. Because as you say, integration is a sort of buzzword at the moment. We've been hearing it sort of from everywhere. And specifically under AUKUS, there is always that question because space has not been sort of solidified as part of AUKUS. It forms part of Pillar 2, but that remains largely undefined. And specifically with space, we've had problems integrating this specifically on a multinational level because space is quite often so highly classified. And especially if we're looking at, for example, satellite communications is also always very classified because even though you might be using the same radio, the underlying security keys might be different. So there's a whole sort of box of problems that's still sort of left to unpack, depending on, you know, what kind of integration of space systems we'll be talking about.
Yeah, look, I would add to that, you know, you're starting to see space appear in AUKUS Pillar 2, the Deep Space Advanced Radar Capability, DARC, was announced as part of a program under AUKUS Pillar 2, which I think was really good, because when AUKUS came out, space wasn't even on the agenda, which I found absolutely bizarre, given the importance of the space domain for everything that we're talking about in AUKUS, both Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. So now I think they're starting to wake up to the fact that this was an oversight. And so they're now trying to bring space in. And there's obvious areas where we can work on space. For example, the space control aspects, I think, are important. There's just recently been an agreement between, not AUKUS, but between US, Australia and Japan on missile defense that potentially could be then worked into Pillar 2 on AUKUS. Obviously, hypersonics in Pillar 2 gives you the long-term pathway to eventual responsive space access using space plane technologies. The fact that the Chinese are developing, the Chinese are developing such a capability themselves should be incentive for us to do the same thing. So, and the other thing is we've got the technology safeguards agreement signed between the US and Australia for allowing US space launches from Australia. So, you know, the potential then for example, a technology safeguards agreement to be signed under AUKUS that would then bring in British space launches from Australia, I think, is something that we should be thinking about. So there's a range of measures that, in terms of space, that could be brought into AUKUS Pillar 2 that I think are definitely worth thinking about.
Now, I don't want to miss this opportunity of having the both of you to explain something completely different. And I'm talking about the reorganization of China's military. And that just came out. The Strategic Support Force was disbanded. It had space, cyber, and information all under one command. But now, instead of being one of five branches of the military, these are three parts that have become individual arms. What does this mean? How does this work? And what does it mean for space?
I think that it's probably a sensible move on the part of the Chinese. I always thought the PLA-SSF structure was a bit odd to basically lump in space, cyber, and network operations in one group. Breaking them up, I think, provides a degree of coherency and clarity. It's interesting that the Chinese use the term aerospace force, which is odd because aerospace is a misnomer. The air and the space domains are completely separate domains. So my guess is what they're actually meaning is that the PLA aerospace force is a space force responding to the US Space Force, which ironically was set up in response to the PLA Strategic Support Force. And I think that based on what the Chinese are saying, and remember that, you know, their public pronouncements don't necessarily reflect their true intentions, they're clearly wanting to focus much more on rapid access, assured access into space, both for satellite launches and also for human space activities, the ability to operate through space, and the ability to exploit the space domain for terrestrial enhancement. And I think that when you look at China's broader space ambitions, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the Chinese are more ambitious or less ambitious in terms of exploiting military space forces beyond the LEO to GEO environment. You know, are they going to go down that path? But it's very early days yet. We're still trying to ascertain exactly what the Chinese mean by making this move in terms of space. And I think only time will tell once we start to see, for example, prioritization of key capability development within space industry in China.
I would agree with Malcolm. I think it's one of those things where it's only time will tell and be able to tell us sort of exactly what this reorganization means. There isn't too much to add because Malcolm is a sort of well of wisdom on these things. But obviously now it's four services. We're talking about aerospace, cyberspace, information and joint logistics support. And I think what we have to bear in mind is that the SSF was always an amalgamation of sort of several departments. So it's just something to bear in mind. And even with the SSF, we weren't always entirely clear which branch actually was responsible for what. So I think there was a sort of report that came out actually just at the end of last year that sort of allowed us to see that it was the Central Military Commission that still had control, for example, over the DAASAT capabilities, that's direct descent anti-satellite weapons, or that, for example, that the offensive cyber and reversible directed energy weapons, for example, in the form of Dazzling, were likely under the sort of local theatre commands. But again, this is a kind of thing where we weren't always entirely clear on the details, and obviously less so now with a reorganisation.
Yeah, and I would add to that, there's a political dimension here in terms of Xi Jinping's determination to wipe out corruption. He's already had a number of key commanders in the PLA removed from their positions. So it could be that this reorganisation is part of that crackdown on corruption to essentially remove key figures that Xi either feels is a threat to him or are, you know, basically unwilling to completely follow Xi's orders, or because they're corrupt.
Juliana, Malcolm, thank you both so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, as always, Laura.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week. For your daily dose of award-winning defense coverage, listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report with Vago Maradian. And for the maritime domain, listen to Cavas Ships with Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and get your air domain news and analysis from the Air Power Podcast with J.J. Gertler and Vago Maradian. I'm Laura Winter. Thank you for listening.